John Turturro's third directorial effort has been generating a lot of publicity recently, not through studio-generated buzz, though, but rather because of a lack of it. The actor, writer, director is self-distributing his $11 million bawdy musical, Romance and Cigarettes, a project that has experienced a tortured history since it was filmed in 2004, and that despite the fact that it boasts a stellar cast. James Gandolfini, Susan Sarandon, Kate Winslet all-star, along with Steve Buscemi, Christopher Walken, Bobby Cannavale, Mandy Moore, Mary Louise Parker, Aida Turturro, Elaine Stritch, Eddie Izzard, Amy Sedaris. You pretty much signed up everybody who's anybody here in New York. And the film is finally being given its U.S. premiere tomorrow at Film Forum on West Houston Street. I'm delighted that it brings John Turturro back to the show today. Hello.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
James Gandolfini plays Nick Murder, a steel worker from Queens who's cheating on his wife, played by Susan Sarandon. Now, immediately we know that there's something awry. Why would anyone want to cheat on Susan Sarandon?
Well, I just think he gets sort of overwhelmed by this young poor girl who's played by Kate Winslet, and so I sort
a
of
very
need
sexy a, woman. Too.
Yes, I need a sort of a force of nature for that to happen, and Kate was the person I always thought of.
Now you have a fairly realistic plot line here.
Yes,
but
I do.
Every once in a while, the characters break out into song.
Right.
What made you want to tell their stories with a mix of dialogue and music?
Well, I grew up in a house filled with song. It was a small house, and we all would escape into our own worlds, you know, through music. I think it was my first form of transportation, at least emotional transportation for me.
And Susan Sarandon says that the lyrics of these sorts of songs are the poetry that the people who live these kinds of lives actually, it's their form of poetry.
Yeah, well, I think popular song has always been a very potent thing amongst people, and especially amongst the working class. Because it's a means of articulation or escape or fantasy or whatever.
Were you inspired by Dennis Potter's story? I guess the first thing I saw was The Singing Detective
right,
on television.
Right.
Then there was Pennies from Heaven.
Right. Well, I thought I was onto an original idea because I kind of stumbled onto it in my second film. I did a small musical sequence in Illuminata. And then my friend said, well, you should see The Singing Detective. And then I watched some of that and some of Lipstick on Your Collar. And I could see right away he was onto something that was very potent. He grew up very poor. His family were miners. But I read this book of interviews with him, and I saw an interview with him. And that, more than anything, I was struck by, you know, his imagination and his use of, he refers to popular music as cheap songs and the potency of them. I didn't want to watch too much because I didn't want to be beholden to the rules that he had set out for himself. He usually had one period of music, and I didn't necessarily want to do that.
Now, you cover a wide range of the kinds of songs these people would be familiar with.
That's right. That they would know, and it would be in the back of their subconscious. So.
In fact, we all do this to some degree, don't we? There's a situation arises in our lives, and suddenly we quote a lyric from a song, or we even break out into that song.
Yeah, well, that was the whole idea, was sort of, you know, deal with it the way people deal with it in everyday life, in their bathroom, in their cars, on the radio, in the basement, bedroom. And I did stumble on to, I thought, something that was interesting, that the people could actually sing with their own private soundtrack, that the soundtrack would be a little more dominant than their voice. And once we saw how that could play and how effective that could be, we decided to basically go with that.
So you use the original record, and then you have the character sing along with it.
Yeah, like James Gandolfini sings with, you know, Egilbert Humperdinck in the first song.
Maybe we should listen to that, because a lot of characterization takes place through the choice of songs. Here is a little bit of James Gandolfini, who's just been confronted by his wife, who's discovered he's having this torrid affair with Tula, played by Kate Winslet.
Tell her about my heart that's slowly dying. Say I can't stop myself from crying. Then I cry my heart out, lonely is a man without love.
Actually, the noises we're hearing are from the garbage men who have joined him, and the song is this kind of chorus, and you get dance numbers going here as well.
Yeah.
Did you discover any unexpected musical talents when these people sang along?
Well, the people, you know, everyone was a little nervous going in. But obviously, you know, some people really just took to it very, very easily. Kate has a very, very good voice. And she, I almost considered just using her version of the little water song that Udo Lemper sings. She sings along with it. But James has a very nice voice, actually, and it was just fun for people. I mean, obviously, Mandy Moore sings, my cousin Aida Totoro sings, Eddie Izzard really played, you know, all the Bach organ music. So people had, you know...
You didn't have to have them faking it.
No, no one really basically faked it, and we tried not to, you know, for the actors to be over choreographed, so you would see kinds of movements that you would see in people's private domain.
But it must have been fun for someone like Susan Sarandon, who doesn't do musicals, and she sings a very different kind of song in contrast to the Engelbert Humperdinck. She sings lip syncs, but also we hear her voice.
Yeah, you do hear her voice too.
Janis Joplin's version of "Piece of My Heart." You know that their marriage is in crisis by the contrast of the songs that they're singing.
Yes, absolutely. We use actually a compilation of Susan, Dusty Springfield, and then cutting into the Janis Joplin version.
Well, most films with a cast of this sort will talk about the incredible budget that they had to spend on all the stars. I suspect getting music rights was as expensive as anything in putting this film together, because you have a lot of different songs, and some of them don't come cheap.
No. Well, the Coen brothers, who executive produced and helped me raise the money and cast and edit the film, they turned me on to Chris Robertson, who runs his company Diamond Time, and Chris and I worked together for about a year and a half clearing the songs. Once we Bruce Springsteen came along with Redheaded Woman, I had written him a letter saying, how would you like to act in a movie? And I think I scared him enough that he gave me a song for a very modest price. But he liked the idea of it, because my idea early on was everyone has an imagination. And, you know, what would it be like, since I'm a Charles Bukowski fan, if I could get Charles Bukowski to sort of collaborate with Bruce Springsteen on a movie? But, you know, their milieus are not that far apart. So once we got that, we worked, you know, song by song, and I would have approximate timings. But we brought it in for a very good price, actually.
$11 million. That's because people work cheap, I guess.
Everybody worked cheap. The music budget, we had prices, and we didn't go beyond what we could afford.
This is really, as much as anything, a labor of love. They must have loved the script. And I hear that you came up with the outline for the movie while you were working on the Coen brothers, Barton Fink.
Right.
You had to type on screen, and so you actually started typing out a film idea?
Well, you know, I saw all these films about writers, and they were always smoking and drinking. And I was telling, it doesn't look like they're really thinking about anything, and I had written a little bit, and I've always liked to write or try to write, and this was something that was going on in my head, and I was thinking about, and I said it would be interesting if I was really typing in my dressing room and on the set. And after going to secretarial school, I improved my typing abilities, and yes, I actually typed Romance and Cigarettes by Barton Fink, and and the first scene in the movie, I think some of it I typed definitely on screen.
Well, there's I'm assuming there's a certain autobiographical aspect to this story.
Yeah,
it's you filmed it in the neighborhood you grew up.
That's
with,
right, Rosedale, Queens.
In Queens.
Yeah,
and I'm guessing that to some degree it's based on your parents.
There's
although there's no John Turturro character in that family. It's three daughters.
Right, right. I mean, certainly there were things that really did, you know, occur, and knowing that, I was able to kind of then just build on it and let my subconscious kind of imagine other things out of that. So I had a real good earthy kind of ground to build on. I think sometimes fantasy is very interesting when it comes out of reality. Folk tales come out of that, the need, you know, for that. So I used to, I mean, to be quite honest, I used to crawl down the hallway of our little house and listen to my mom and all the ladies in my neighborhood commiserate about their, you know, relationships and marriages and things. And I was always kind of eavesdropping. And I have to say, I was always quite taken by the strength of many of these women who went through all kinds of different things. And it definitely made an imprint on me.
I'm talking with John Turturro, whose film Romance and Cigarettes is finally being opened here in New York at the Film Forum tomorrow. That's on West Houston Street, and has an incredible cast. How did you get all these people to agree to appear for what I assume was little or no money? I'm sure that Aida Turturro, your cousin, did it because out of family responsibility. Steve Buscemi, well, he's a neighbor of yours in Park Slope. But Christopher Walken, Eddie Izzard, Elaine Stritch.
Well, we did a reading of it. Quite simply, we did. The Coen brothers really liked it. We did a reading of it. And James actually participated in the reading with many of these people, and people just really liked it. It was much longer, and the response was, you know, terrific. And people were excited to try to do something that they hadn't done before, but they also knew where it was coming from.
And James at that time was riding high on The Sopranos,
yes.
But I'm sure he also wanted to show that he could do other kinds of things.
Yeah.
And you got the support of the studio at the time.
Right.
And then that was United Artists. And then United Artists was sold or merged with MGM.
They were already merged with MGM.
Uh-huh. And then what happened?
They were very much behind the film. They had seen rough cut screenings of it, and then they tested it. They were planning a 500 screen release. They had had a trailer and a poster. I knew they were going to be sold eventually, but everyone assured me that it would happen after the film came out. But the sale went down very quickly. And in a film like this, you know, you have to kind of prep everyone to understand what you're trying to do, that audiences do really respond to it. And our only request was, you know, for the new company that bought it, they had many different departments and many different sort of avenues that we could have distributed us, that they see it with an audience. And that never happened. Because people feel like I can be the judge of it. But because they inherited it and they didn't own worldwide rights to it, they just felt like, well, this is not for us. And then when we tried to sell it, the asking price was high. We had people who were interested. And we got caught between a rock and a hard place. And so it came out in Europe first. And it's done quite well in certain territories. In Italy.
7 months in Italy, I guess.
Yes, that's right. And they released it, interesting enough, very similar to the way the United Artists was going to release it, as a sort of in-between type of film.
Because that's part of the problem, I suspect, here. The studios know what to do with a thriller. They know what to do with certain kinds of comedies and teen films. But this is a quirky film that doesn't fit into any predictable genre, rather comfortably. And that's part of the fun of it, I think.
Yes, it is.
I mean, it isn't... We have too many films that look like they were written by computers.
Yeah.
You don't look like a computer to me, John.
No, I'm not a computer. And it's interesting, whenever I've shown it to a group of people, the audience has always responded in a very appreciative way. So that's what kept me going all during this time. And I do think it's when people inherit things, when these mergers happen, you're never going to be examined the same way. You're very fortunate if you do. Occasionally a film does, you know, creep through that way. But it's I wouldn't have made the film if I didn't have a distributor.
And you've always wanted to be a director, or is that something that came along?
I think that's something that's almost been, there have been some stories that I've wanted to tell. And
you write comfortably?
At times. It depends what I'm working on. I have a tremendous respect for a person who's considered a writer, but people like to work with me, and I've been offered other things, but to direct, but I'm not that interested sometimes, and you know, I have other projects I'd like to do, but this is something that I thought, well, it has there's a commercial viability to it, and I thought, well, you know, possibly that'll help me do other things, and actually, the people who have seen it are interested in me doing other things, so we'll see.
Well, I understand that you're going to be doing a New York version of Theo van Gogh's, did that fall through?
I'm working on this. We'll see.
When Steve Buscemi was here, he did a wonderful film based on one of those.
I thought Steve did a terrific job on it. So I'm working on the script.
But we have had a whole bunch of people in New York who've acted and directed.
Right.
Is there something that goes on here? I mean, we have Marty Scorsese, who's basically a director, but he's a pretty good actor.
Right, he is.
De Niro's done both. Spike Lee, of course, Woody Allen.
Right.
Do you think it's something that happens here more than in the West Coast?
You know, possibly. Maybe people have...
They're out of the theater in New York?
You know, that's possible also. But maybe people have, you know, more... Maybe their minds are percolating differently here. You know, if you have a story to tell or something that you'd like to express, I think it's very interesting because you're kind of confronted with what you think.
Does it
is
help?
Interesting.
Does it help that you are an actor when you're directing other actors?
I think it helped in this movie. Sidney Lumet saw the movie and he was quite taken with it, and he asked me what kind of drugs did I give everyone to get them to be so relaxed and uninhibited. I worked with people in rehearsals. I made them do exercises. I improvised with them, and I did everything that I think that I would like to have done for me.
Because there's a lot of spontaneity in the performances. Were they also ad-libbing at times? Did you encourage improvisation?
We did a little bit in rehearsal, and then I would incorporate that. But basically, the script was pretty much the way it is, except for one of the second half of Kate Winslet's sex scenes.
Well, we'll talk about that off the air, but I just thought we'd give people a little taste of how it sounds, not the singing. Here's James Gandolfini and Elaine Stritch, along with Steve Buscemi, in a scene.
I got 1 foot on the banana peel and 1 foot in the grave. Can you do this to me? You have got dinosaur balls, Buster. I should have clopped him off when you were a kid.
I'm your son, Ma. I could use some help.
Does it look like I'm wearing a white uniform?
I'm supposed to be number one.
You overshot your boundaries, number one. You go and get yourself a mistress, and on top of that, you got yourself circumcised. Jesus, we're not even Jewish.
I told him not to do it.
Shut up! Who asked you?
That's just, we're laughing here, and you've seen this film a billion times. John Turturro, thank you so much. The film opens tomorrow at the Film Forum on Westhausen Street, and let's go out with a bit more of Engelbert Humperdinck. The film, which we are talking about, is Romance and Cigarettes, and has an all-star cast and fabulous actor-director. Thanks again, John.
Thanks for having me.
Say I can't stop myself from crying. Every day I wake up and I start to break up. Lonely as a man without love. Every day I start out and I cry my heart out. Lonely as a man without love. Every day I wake up and I start to break up. Knowing it's cloudy above. Every day I start out.